Hello and welcome to the Engagement Coach Podcast.
Welcome to the Engagement Coach Podcast with your host, Amrit Sander. So we're back, series two. The Engagement Coach Podcast is back. Thank you so much for all our listeners and our guests last year. We had a phenomenal response and we're back with series two with some new guests and new topics. And today we're going to kick off the whole series with a fantastic guest who's worked with us before. He's a friend of the company, Andrew Marcinko. He's going to talk to us about organizational identity. Now, as leaders and managers across organizations with hybrid working, how do you maintain a level of organizational identity when most people aren't in the office or the work environment? What does that leave us with in terms of the work environment? Does this now become a social space where people can come and go as they please? And what happens to the organizational culture? And that's what we want to try and discuss today with Andrew and try and shed some light with his expertise. But before we do that, let's just welcome Andrew to the show. So hi, Andrew. Welcome to our podcast. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So Andrew, we created a series called Expert Insights and you were fantastic in getting involved in that. You've created a number of videos for us in the past. We know you and your expertise, but just for everybody who's listening and watching, it'd be really good to understand your background and your speciality, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure. And so much fun doing those videos, by the way. Really good experience. My first time using a green screen as well. So it was exciting. I'm Andrew Marcinko. I'm an assistant professor at Durham University in the psychology department. But kind of varied. My background is in organizational and work psychology. That's what I did my PhD in. But now I'm more focused on what I guess is becoming known as sort of behavioral science. So with sort of this particular focus on behavior change. There's been a lot of talk about behavioral science and COVID and everything else. So it's becoming a popular topic. So yeah, a bit of a mix of some of this traditional organizational psychology mixed in with some of the sort of behavior change and behavioral science things that are becoming popular recently is my background.
And they are becoming popular, Andrew. I mean, there's so much going on in the world. And, you know, we've gone through this whole year and a half experiment of human population undergoing a huge change. You know, in organizations, one of the things that we or employees get frustrated with is you know, the change that we're being put through. And here, everyone's been undergoing a huge change. I want to explore that a bit more based on your speciality. And, you know, there's leaders and managers out there. We talk to CEOs and boardrooms all the time. And one of the things that they're saying to us is we are meant to be creating this nice holistic culture. But how do I create a culture when there's nobody here to create a culture with? You know, I don't want to be seen to be the bad person who doesn't agree with hybrid working. I really want people to be happy. But by being at home, I don't see them. And so as my role as a leader, how do I go about doing that? And it'll be good to know a little bit about the social identity theory, if you can just share a little bit about that and what we're expecting of leaders and how do they go about doing all of this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's really a unique challenge. And I probably forewarn everyone up front, there's no sort of perfect fix for this. If I had the one perfect thing that every leader can do to adjust to remote work, I'd share it right now and end the podcast. Obviously, that's not really an option. But when we as sort of psychologists think about identity and in the business world and at work, something you mentioned called the social identity theory and the social identity approach is really prominent for us. So this is thinking about and approaching intergroup processes between people in the context of how people perceive themselves as belonging to different groups in their lives. So if you think about yourself, we often think in terms of demographic variables, whether it's our race or our gender or our nationality. So I'm, you know, a white man, I'm American, if you've probably gathered from my accent. But it goes even deeper than that as well to your personality variables, to your employer, to where you went to university, to what football club you support. So these groups that we belong to are endless. They're infinite. And they shape our behavior. So we want the groups that we perceive ourselves as belonging to do well. We want them to be perceived well because we want them to reflect well back on us. So, I know you're based outside of Birmingham and I'm a big Aston Villa supporter. So I want Aston Villa's reputation to increase because it reflects back on me unconsciously, unconsciously. So that can be a good thing, but I can also become biased toward Aston Villa as a group then, because I want them to reflect well on me. I become biased toward them, which is sort of silly when we talk about football. And I've been watching the Euros this week, and you can see some of those fan groups having these sort of silly processes, but becomes more challenging in the workplace. And when we think about things like, you know, race and gender, but also where we work and these sort of group memberships, we can have sort of biases toward them in ways that aren't so silly or beneficial and become very consequential. So when we talk about identificational work, we think a lot about this concept of social identity and how we view ourselves, either consciously or unconsciously, as belonging to all of these different groups.
So then as leaders and managers, knowing that, you know, I guess the ultimate goal is that we want to create this cohesive group where people feel proud to belong to that group. They're invested emotionally into that group. So how do leaders and managers now in the current climate and going forward? I mean, I heard Amazon are now saying, actually, we want people back in the offices 3 days right. a week, you know? Yeah. And there's other companies out there that are saying, actually, we don't want you back at all. We're going to get rid of our offices.
Right.
We want you working from home. How do leaders go about creating an identity in an environment where people are in this hybrid or virtual world?
Yeah, well, and this is that difficult question. If it were me, I think this is an opportunity for a real reset of how businesses approach this. You know, you hate to frame anything that's been as terrible as COVID has as an opportunity, but in the end, it's given us this chance to rethink this approach for decades here. Building an incredibly strong sort of organizational identity has been goal number one for a lot of leaders. And the obvious case studies come in Silicon Valley. If you think about Apple and Facebook and Google, where they have these campuses and they feed you there, you have yoga classes there, you have meditation rooms. They wanted those people's lives to almost circle around their professional office in the pursuit of this really strong culture and identity. But even before COVID, I think we were starting to see some cracks in that approach. And you were starting to see that employees were starting to insist on like bringing more of themselves to work and their authentic selves, and not just for work, but their politics, their social values and things like that. And all of a sudden, you know, Google and Facebook were here saying, well, wait a second, we wanted you to center your entire lives around the office, but not those parts of your life, you know, please leave them away. And that obviously isn't going to work, right? You can't sort of have your cake and eat it too, in the classic saying. So for me, and maybe a little idealistic, but I think it's a time to almost separate that a little bit again and stop this relentless pursuit to have people orient their lives around the workplace 24/7 and accept that as employees, they commit to you for their 35, 40 hours a week, whatever it is, but then have to have some separation where they go back to their families and their friends and their lives and their things outside of work. So I think to some extent, I would recommend allowing your employees to do that and not pushing the envelope so much where you try to force them into this being the primary identification of their lives, which is just, it's not going to be possible if people are working remote for 3, 4, 5 days a week. I don't think we're ever going to get back to that same level of, you know, intense identification that maybe we had sort of in the early 2000s there.
That's really interesting. You know, you're almost saying, what you're saying, I think, is that actually identification doesn't have to be it. That I can still identify with people, with the organization I'm with, just because I'm not there full time on site all the time. And you mentioned Google. I had the privilege of going to see Google, the campus there. And whilst it was fantastic, I agree with you. I walked away thinking, wow, this is a bit spooky. There's barbers there. There were dry cleaners there. You didn't have to go off campus for anything. And whilst you were talking there, I remember reading, it's just yesterday or the day before, I was reading about a chap called Robert Owen, and he was one of the first industrialists and with a mill workers. And he tried to put this notion across that says, actually, work shouldn't be everything, you know, and he tried to split the day up and, you know, he limited the working hours of people. He wanted his education being brought in. And it's almost going back to that reset you said is how do we get back to this balance that work isn't everything? And that becomes my identity. I can still relate to the organization, I guess.
Yeah. And I mean, we're seeing this trend in hiring now, where, you know, if you've been following the news from the States in particular, where employers are having a harder time finding employees, even though there are employees looking for work, because employees are starting more and more to demand those sort of opportunities. And they're not willing to put in incredible over-the-top, you know, overtime hours anymore, right? They're demanding having sort of their own separate lives and being supported in that as well. So I think from a competitive advantage for employers, becoming a company that is recognized, where in a sense you can kind of create that as your identity within the company, if that makes sense. So rather than the company culture being you're here 80 hours a week, you sleep here, you meditate here, you do your, you know, get your haircut here, instead of the company culture becomes that bit of separation where people are able, encouraged to keep those lives outside. And then that in itself can become an identity, right? Identity, developing a strong identity doesn't require 80 hours a week commitment. I could go back to Aston Villa, a big football fan. I have a strong identity with Aston Villa. I've watched, you know, the one game a week, you know, maybe I read an article here and there, but that 3 hours a week, and that's still a really strong identity for me. So it's not about overkill with this thing. You can still develop a really passionate identity, and part of that identity can be that flexibility that allows your employees to have their own lives and excel and be happy outside of the workplace.
I love that example. And again, you just, while you're talking there, you're sort of provoking thoughts in my mind. I used to do karate when I was a kid, and I would only go twice a week. I strongly identified with the club I was with. The bulk of my life was nothing to do with karate, but I had an affinity to the Wadaroo style that we did, the club I was with. That was completely it. So, okay, so this is about reframing how we're seeing the world of work, that actually we can identify very strongly, even though we're not there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, and you know, you talked about, you know, we're talking about inclusive cultures then, and how do we go about creating this culture where people belong? I wonder whether, and you can help me out here, but I wonder whether the current way of working now, if this becomes the norm, that people are going to be hybrid working or working from home, is actually more embracing of other cultures. So we are more welcoming now, that because we don't have the uncomfortable, awkward moment. I've experienced them in my life, right? There's no two ways about it. But actually, when I'm working from the safety, the psychological safety of my own home, I guess, these four walls that I built, and, you know, it's my domain, but I'm working with a company. Are we creating an environment then that's also more welcoming to other cultures and diversity and inclusion?
Yeah, I think there's potential there, but I'd hesitate to say it's sort of something that's a given or it's going to happen, because just as you say, that there are obvious examples where this remote working could break down some of the most, you know, well-known structural and systemic barriers that people have come up against in their careers, you know, particularly those from minority or ethnic backgrounds or women in the, you know, professional workplace. I think there's also then the potential for new ones to emerge that are equally troubling. You know, I think we're still so new into this that I, as someone who tries to be sort of an evidence-based practitioner, I have a hard time having any real firm evidence to support this either way. But, you know, I think there are obvious issues for women who typically take on more of the childcare responsibilities that the data shows us, that working from home has a significant, you know, potential to be additionally challenging for folks in that position. And some of the same, you know, social barriers that have been sort of a systemic barrier to the advancement of people of color, different people from different religious backgrounds over the years. There's no reason those are just going to disappear, you know, over with remote work. We've said, you know, things like going to sporting events or happy hour drinks have long been something that's been talked about as being exclusive of certain groups. You know, people of different religious backgrounds or people who have childcare responsibilities are often excluded from those sort of informal interactions. And I don't necessarily see why remote work is going to automatically overcome those barriers. But it does definitely give us some opportunities, as you say, that some of the issues you mentioned, psychological safety, where people may feel like they're, you know, I'm the only one like me in this workplace and made to feel uncomfortable, or if their traditions or approaches or accents or way of speech make them stand out when they're in the offensive person, there's definitely a route to overcoming that remotely. But I definitely wouldn't say it's going to be automatic. I think managers and leaders need to be every bit as active and committed to mitigating the effects of those sort of systemic barriers as they were prior to remote work. And I certainly wouldn't counsel anyone that, oh, remote work will take care of a lot of these things for you, because that's probably not the case.
I guess there's the other thing. And again, I remember my time in corporate life. The people who back then used to work remotely, which was, you know, an inconsiderably small number, and it was unusual, there was a fear of missing out. They would have to try and work harder to catch up on communications, work harder to catch up on meetings or anything that they'd missed out. And inevitably, and I'm generalizing here, but this was my own observations, they tended to miss out on promotions because they weren't seen, they weren't there every day. So there, I guess there is a risk here that we might be embracing hybrid working or working from home, but then those who happen to be in the office more often, I guess there's a risk that, you know, those who are obviously being seen by the leadership team more often, there's a chance that they'll get promoted more often, or they'll be in the know, and there's this fear of missing out, which might compel others to think, I know we're told we can work from home, but actually I've got no choice. I've got to come in, because if I don't, I'm going to end up missing out on things.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm blanking on the author of this research, but it just came out this week looking at sort of workplace friendships, the link between workplace friendships and well-being. And just how important that is to people's happiness and well-being over the years. And they found that people who had strong friendships with colleagues were consistently more content with their jobs and happier overall as the years went by, and particularly good friend relationships with sort of manager people too, which obviously sounds a little bit intuitive. If you're friends with your manager, you're probably happy at work. But the data really showed that workplace friendships do have that positive impact. And the other thing I'd sort of mention on that front too is I still don't know if we have as complete a sense for how well this sort of virtual interaction can replicate the information elaboration, the information sharing that goes on between people. So I think we'd like to think that Microsoft Teams and Zoom and these virtual meetings, that we can replicate that, but I'm not convinced, and I'm not sure the data supports that at this stage either with the current technology. And that, I mean, from an inclusivity standpoint, that's absolutely essential, because we know that I talk a lot about work with teams and teamwork, and particularly diverse teams. And we know that diverse groups of people can be much more effective than more homogenous groups. But that effectiveness comes from what we call information elaboration. So how well do they exchange information between each other? Do they bring their own unique perspectives and outlooks and lived experiences into that conversation? That's where the benefits come from to diversity in an organization. And I think there definitely should be a concern that we may lose some of that if we shift fully to these sort of virtual meetings where people, you know, we've all had technical difficulties over the last 18 months at some point or other. And there's a decent chance that people just aren't as comfortable or aren't as able to bring in those unique outlooks, experiences, knowledges, and skills into the conversation in this virtual environment. So from a diversity has the potential to make us more effective sort of perspective, there's definitely a major risk from a shift to virtual meetings as well.
Also, you know, Andrew, I'm staring at a camera, right, to make you feel comfortable, you know, and yeah. You're actually to my right hand side here.
Yeah.
But I'm staring at you so that I can, you know, so that you feel that I'm engaging with you. You know, and we often hear in the office, we call it the Zoom face. You know, have you got your Zoom face on? We're on show. And we make the assumption then that people from different cultures and backgrounds are comfortable staring at a camera. And then how do I come across if I'm not staring at a camera? Or, you know, we then, there's a risk that we exclude people from different cultures, because this is an alien concept that we're all trying to adapt to. And those who happen to adapt to it better may end up coming across better, even though it's got nothing to do with their skills and behaviors in any other area other than I just come across as more engaging type thing. You know, it's a it's a bit of a minefield, isn't it?
And it's just, I mean, so Zoom fatigue is absolutely a thing, I think. We've all sort of experienced that subjectively over the last 18 months, I'm sure. But I think scientifically, this is definitely a thing. And it just, it speaks to the scope of the change we're facing, how many different just psychological considerations there are to this. Because from an evolutionary perspective, we know that being in the physical presence of other people has significant sort of not only psychological but biological effects on human beings. You know, that's deeply rooted in our evolutionary makeup. And we don't, let's be honest, we don't have a clue at this point how shifting 50%, 75% of those interactions to virtual is going to change things. I there may be smarter evolutionary psychologists out there with a better sense than me, but I think we really, it's going to take years to understand how limiting those in-person interactions is affecting us both psychologically and biologically. So it's really important to monitor these things and be flexible and be adaptable as we go on. So if we see things aren't working, people, you know, monitor people's well-being, be aware of how your employees are doing, whether that's surveys, whether that's giving them opportunities, make sure they have plenty of opportunities to give feedback. Just keeping an eye on these things, because there are, as you say, sort of these pitfalls and landmines and challenges sort of scattered dangerously throughout this sort of change. So it's more important than ever to track feedback from our employees.
And I want to go back to the original start of this when we, you know, the leaders and how do they create an environment. There's lots of organizations out there. Every organization has values or principles, and here's what we stand for. Often in a building, you could see the people's behaviors, you could see how they interact with each other, and you've got a gut feel, a sense of how well are we demonstrating these. Obviously, you're not going to use that as your only data point, but as a leader walking through the office, you've got a feel of, you know, what's the vibe and how are we doing? Again, working from home now, I guess the other challenge we've got is what value are values if you can't see how people are interacting? How we get work done is only through this medium of video or emailing. You know, I've resorted to phoning people more often because I just don't want to be videoing all the time. And I have more fruitful conversations on the phone because I can think without worrying about how I look and how I come across and which way am I facing. How do leaders go about enhancing the values in this hybrid world that, you know, yes, you can work from home, but you know, what value do values have then?
Yeah. And I mean, so we always talk about sort of, we talk about culture and we talk about climate. So culture is exceedingly top down and tends to be more difficult to change in the short term. It often goes back to the sort of vision and outlook of the founders of the company, and changes very, very gradually and has to be sort of exclusively from the top. But from the organizational, you know, management, academic literature, climate is the sort of more flexible variation of this. And this is where not just the CEO, but leaders at different levels can have an effect on how employees perceive this from day to day. And I think you can really sort of look to the leadership research here, and people have probably heard about these ideas like authentic leadership and servant leadership and transformational leadership. And there are different approaches, and different people fit naturally into these sort of roles. But I think there's a real opportunity for authentic leadership to shine when it comes to climate change. So really trying to role model the sort of behaviors you're keen and making yourself visible and being open and transparent with your employees. So there's a concept called leader member exchange, which sort of tries to measure and quantify the flow of information between leaders and followers within an organization. And that's sort of the central concept within authentic leadership. And the part that a lot of leaders miss out on is the flow of information from the followers back to the leader. So most leaders are pretty good about talking and sharing their ideas and telling people what to do, or at least reasonably good at it. But it's taking that information from your employees, from your followers back in, and not just for show, but genuinely soliciting their advice, their feedback, their thoughts, and making a transparent effort to incorporate that into your actions as a leader. So if I were counseling a leader right now, what can the leadership literature tell us to do? It would be that, a focus on this authentic approach, and particularly into soliciting and acting on transparently the feedback of your employees.
It's really interesting. Authentic leadership is a real, it resonates so much with me. And I guess throughout my career, I've seen leaders who didn't come across as authentic. They were trying too hard. They were trying to be something they weren't. Or the environment. I've seen such changes in leaders driven by the context. That actually I vowed I would never work with some people again, only to find complete opposite in another climate, in another environment. So what gets in the way of this authentic leadership? What makes people inauthentic? I mean, I guess that's the extreme end of it, but you know, what stops people, leaders, being something that they can ground in and others can resonate with and relate to?
Yeah, I mean, so there's so many things you can talk about there, but one thing I've focused on a little bit is, it falls within that sort of transparency, but particularly being willing to acknowledge challenges, or even, to put it a little more bluntly, to acknowledge failures. Because no leader is perfect, right? No leader has ever done everything just right, made every decision right. But within companies, it's, you know, there's such intensity to succeed and to be successful and to move the stock price or move the value up to sell, that leaders are so reticent to acknowledge when something has not gone right. And I've done a couple little experiments, you know, so I mentioned I do a lot of EDI work, and we found that we tweaked some websites, you know, fake organizational websites about EDI policies and practices, just to include one sentence, one extra sentence that sort of said, you know, we acknowledge that we haven't been as successful as we would have liked to in the past when it comes to EDI. And that one extra sentence, it was 13 words, made such a difference when you asked the participants in the experiment, you know, how connected do you feel to this organization? Do you feel committed to this organization? Do you trust this organization? That tiny little bit absolutely made the difference. So whether it's from the sort of organizational messaging standpoint or the leadership standpoint, being willing sometimes to be vulnerable, to acknowledge that something hasn't gone well or that you personally have made a mistake, it's scary to do. And, you know, I'm not saying you need to be constantly bragging about everything you've done wrong, because no leader wants to do that. But being willing to point that out once in a while and to share that sort of vulnerability with your employees really underpins the success of that sort of authentic approach to leadership.
And that nicely feeds into the wonderful work by Paul Zak, who we had on the podcast talking about oxytocin and vulnerability and trust. And I've seen that. And I do challenge organizations all the time we're working with them. You know, when are you going to celebrate this week's biggest cock-up? You know, let people know these things happen, and what learnings have we taken from it? So sure, that's a fantastic point to end upon. Andrew, thank you. So look, in summary, what we're saying is there's huge challenges out there. We're not quite sure where we're going to end up. Hybrid working or working from home isn't a solution. It may be, but we're going to have to keep an eye on it. How do we keep people connected, inclusive, create inclusive cultures? How do we keep people from missing out? So this is going to, it's going to require leaders to really dig deep, be transparent, really communicate. Final point, Andrew, is there any research you've come across recently that you think that's really interested you? So you're coming across research all the time as an academic. You know, what's the one piece of research you've walked away thinking, wow, that's really interesting, that's made you sit up and think, wow? Anything that you've just come across recently, or
Emery, you underestimate how many exams I've had to mark in the last month. This hasn't been my best month for reading research. But no, I think there's actually, in stuff that I've just come across from a couple of researchers in Holland that I really, really like, Don van Nippenberg and Astrid Holman. And they have started working on sort of combining some of the ideas around performance and diversity. So what they describe as sort of a synergy climate within an organization. So when an organization views diversity and approaches diversity as something that is a benefit to the company, that allows them to be more effective as what they do, not just, all right, we need to be diverse and then we can get back to what we do as a company, but diversity is an essential part of what we do as a company. And trying to combine that idea with more individual levels of leadership. So for the past decade, that line of research has been very tied to sort of organizational level concerns. And just in the last year or so, a couple of them have published really good papers sort of outlining what the processes will look like to bring that sort of approach down to the leadership level. So I think if I could give you sort of an area of research to really keep an eye on over the next 5 years and see some good empirical results coming, I think that might be it.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Andrew. So look, thank you for joining me today. Thank you for the work you've done with us in the past on Expert Insights and everything else. And I'm sure we're going to be hearing much more from you. So that's Andrew, who's joined me today. Thank you, Andrew. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Join us again next week. More guests, more topics, talking about organizational culture, leadership development, and everything else in between. Amrit Sander from The Engagement Coach. I will see you soon. Take care.
The Engagement Coach Podcast.